Chapter 23. Josie left a long letter for her father after she had changed and packed, before she and Raymond drove her car into New York. The letter told him that they were going to be married immediately, and that they had decided to have it done quietly, even invisibly, for the entirely apparent political considerations. The letter also told him of how sublimely, utterly happy she was. It said they would return as soon as possible, and beseeched her father to tell no one of the marriage, because Raymond's conviction was that his mother would use it at once to political advantage, and that he felt his mother's political advantages were profitless, even detrimental to anyone concerned. Josie and Raymond reached his apartment at 3 a.m. after driving into the city in Josie's car. They undressed instantly and reflexively, and found each other hungrily. Josie wept, and she laughed with joy and disbelief that her true life, the only life she had ever touched, because it had touched her simultaneously, had been given back to her. Such an instant ago he had paddled their wide canoe across that lake of purple wine toward a pin of light high in the sky which would widen and widen and widen while she slept, until it had blanched the blackness. Another day would have lighted his face as he stood there before her. She had been dreaming. She had not been waiting so long for him. She had been dreaming. She had gone to sleep beside a mountain lake, and she had dreamed that he had gone away from her, and that they had waited across the world from each other until the dream had finished. He loved her. He loved her. Raymond mailed a concise letter to Joe Downey of the Daily Press concerning his first vacation in 4 years, explained that his column had been written ahead for 5 days, and announced that he would return, without saying where he was going, in time to cover the conventions. They drove her car to Washington and parked it in the Senate garage. They took the first flight out of Washington to Miami using the names John Starr and Marilyn Ridgway for the manifest, then an afternoon plane from Miami to San Juan, Puerto Rico. They were married in San Juan at 5:37 p.m., using their passports for identification in lieu of birth certificates, a condition which helped the justice to remember them 2 days later when the FBI office in San Juan responded to the Bureau's general alarm for Raymond. They left San Juan via PAA at 7:05 p.m. and arrived soon after in Antigua, where the presentation of one of the many mysterious cards in Raymond's wallet secured him credit and lodgings for their wedding night at the Mill Reef Club. The following afternoon, they set sail as the only passengers aboard a chartered schooner with a professionally aloof crew, on a honeymoon voyage through the islands of Guadeloupe, Dominica, Martinique, St. Lucia, Barbados, Grenada, Tobago, and Trinidad. When Raymond's mother returned to the library and found him gone, she panicked for the first time in her memory. She had to force herself to sit very, very still for nearly 20 minutes to regain control of herself. By then, she needed a fix so badly that she nearly scrambled up the back stairs to get heroin and an arm banger. She changed from the costume of the dainty milkmaid, coked to the very retinas, and calmly slipped into something she could wear to the airport, thence to Washington. She leaned back and closed her eyes, her body allowing the serenity to wash over it, and she considered quite objectively what must be done to move through this catastrophe. Although she had the servants seek Raymond throughout the house and grounds, and she checked his room herself, she understood best the intuition which told her that he must have fled from her, and that his mechanism had broken down. She knew as well as she could tell the time that, having been triggered by the Red Queen, when the Red Queen had been removed from his sight, he would have remained in the locked room for the rest of his days in complete suspension of faculties, if the mechanism had been operating as constructed. She had elaborate cause to panic. Chun-Jin missed Raymond approximately 2 hours later than his mother did, but his alarm was relayed into the Soviet apparatus via a telephone tape recorder in Arlington, Virginia, immediately, so that they knew about Raymond's disappearance before his mother could reach Washington to tell them. They had panicked, too. A general order was issued to trace the fugitive through their own organizations, but as they confined their search within the borders of the continental United States, they got nowhere as the days went on and on. The FBI resumed its interrupted surveillance of Raymond at Martinique. They were able, through some fine cooperation, to persuade 2 crew members to jump ship, whereupon 2 agents of the Bureau were signed on the schooner as working hands. The Bureau had found Josie's car in the Senate garage, and she and Raymond were immediately identified as connections of senators, and he as the well-known newspaperman. The Bureau was about to discuss the matter with Senator Jordan when the San Juan office reported the marriage. After that, the names of Mr. and Mrs. Raymond Shaw showed up on the PAA manifest for the skim to Antigua. Then, quickly after that, like gypsy finger-snapping, at the Mill Reef Club, on the Wright Wharf, on the voyage plot filed at the company's office, then at Martinique, where the two agents boarded to protect the blissfully ignorant couple from they knew not what. If Marco had not been the little gentleman about the whole thing, if he had not been so hipped on the sanctity of the honeymoon in an entirely subjective manner, he would have been one of those two agents who boarded as crew, and he would have had a forced deck of 52 queens of diamonds in his duffel, those with keen hindsight said later. However, he could see no harm coming to them while they were that far out at sea, so he planned to visit Raymond at the earliest possible moment upon the honeymooners' return. Josie and Raymond returned to New York on the Friday evening before the Monday morning when the convention was scheduled to open at Madison Square Garden. They had been away for 29 days. They moved into Raymond's apartment with golden tans and foaming joys. It took two calls to locate Josie's father, because he had closed the summer house on Long Island and had moved back to the house on 63rd Street. He insisted that they have a wedding celebration that evening because of the wonderful sounds and the sounds within those sounds, far within his daughter's happy voice. They celebrated at an Italian restaurant on East 55th Street. The city was rapidly tilting with the arrival of politician statesmen and statesman politicians and just routine hustlers for the convention, so it was no trick at all for the newspaper in opposition to the Daily Press to learn of the celebrating party of three, and in no time a photographer had appeared on the scene, taken a picture, and confirmed the story of the marriage. That being the case, Raymond explained earnestly to Josie, he had no choice but to alert his own paper, because it would be a bitter occasion indeed if they were beat to the street with his own picture. So a press photographer and reporter were rushed to the restaurant, which heretofore had been famous only for the manufacture of the most formidable martinis on the planet. A journalistic coincidence was duly observed in the Wayward Press Department of the New Yorker in a subsequent examination of the national press reports published during the national political conventions. The survey noted that both newspapers reporting the Jordan-Shaw marriage at the same instant employed lead paragraphs that were almost identical. Each newspaper made a comparison with the plot of Romeo and Juliet, a successful play by an English writer which had been taken from the Italian of Masuccio di Salerno. Both paragraphs referred to the groom as being of the house of Montague, Iselin, and to the bride as being of the house of Capulet, Jordan, then went on into divergent reviews of the murderous bitterness between the two senators, recalling Senator Iselin's startling press conference of 1 week previous, at which he had charged Senator Jordan with high treason, brandishing papers held high as absolute proof that Jordan had sold his country out to the Soviets, and stating that at the instant the Senate reconvened, he would move for, 1, Senator Jordan's impeachment, and 2, for a civil trial at the end of which, the senator demanded passionately, the only possible verdict would be that this traitor to liberty and to the only perfect way of life must be hanged by the neck until dead. Senator Jordan's only response had been made upon a single mimeographed sheet holding a single sentence. Distributed to all press agencies, it said, "How long will you let this man use you and trick you?"